Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
With just 4 days to go till the general election, we'll hear from the top women of the Democratic Party on what they think of their gubernatorial candidate, Charlie Crist.
I think he's great.
I am hoping Charlie Crist will be true to his word. And if he doesn't, then you can best believe that the Democratic African American Women's Caucus will be holding him accountable.
Also this week, we'll get an overview of some constitutional amendments, starting with Amendment 1.
Amendment 1 would be the single largest conservation initiative at the state level in American history.
We'll also take a gander at Amendments 2 and 3 and look into how the existence of the state's children's councils will soon depend on voter approval. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Soon, hopefully very soon, the unrelenting tsunami of political TV ads will recede into memory, although most folks probably wish they could simply forget about them entirely. Anyway, the election is this coming Tuesday. Already millions of Floridians have cast ballots, whether through early in-person voting or by mail. But millions more haven't voted yet, and this week's Capitol Report is really dedicated to them. The final Quinnipiac poll of the Florida governor's race suggests more men tend to favor Governor Rick Scott, while by a double-digit margin, more women favor Democratic challenger Charlie Crist. Sasha Cordner has more on that story.
Please join me in welcoming the candidate, the man who will lead the Democratic ticket to victory in November, Governor Charlie Crist.
That's Nan Rich, who ran against Charlie Crist in the Democratic gubernatorial primary in August and lost. Just days after the primary, she spoke at a Democratic Unity rally to show unification of all the party candidates who won and lost.
In every election, someone wins and someone loses. Tuesday night, I placed a call to Governor Crist to offer him my congratulations on his win and my support. But on Tuesday, November 4th, it will be Rick Scott calling Charlie Crist. And Florida will take a giant step in the right direction.
But things weren't always this friendly. Crist refused to debate her leading up to the primary, and during their ongoing battle, she talked to several news outlets about their differences, mainly that.
I am a lifelong Democrat.
You know, as I mentioned before, I'm a true Democrat. I have been a Democrat all my adult life since I registered. I have a record. Certainly, his record to date would show that he's not a progressive.
People can evolve on an issue. The issue here is changing all positions 180 degrees.
Now, Rich says Crist is the Democrats' best chance at getting into the governor's mansion, and she says he really cares about people.
I just, you know, believe at this point that the person that best reflects, you know, my issues and the issues that are important to me are on the Democratic side of the ticket and not with, you know, the current administration and Rick Scott. When I look at the child welfare system in this state, it's a disaster what has happened. And we have the highest waiting list for seniors that we've ever had for home and community-based care. These are people issues.
And others agree that the so-called people's governor really does care.
I have known Charlie Crist since he was a senator in the legislature. Like Charlie, I trust him to have the interest of real Floridians first and foremost in his mind. I believe that he will take policy stances that will protect Florida. I think he loves our state. I believe his concern for our state is very genuine.
That's Florida Democratic Party Chair Allison Tant, who's known him for more than 20 years. She says she believes Crist is the only real choice because she says he hasn't put people over politics like Scott on many issues. She used education as an example.
When Charlie Crist was governor, he funded education. He actually sought a budget that funded public education. When Rick Scott became governor, the first thing he did was take $1.3 billion out of the public education budget, acting almost as if he were some sort of corporate raider, strip mining budgets for children, strip mining budgets for teachers.
So what about his running mate?
I think he's great.
Like Scott, Chris chose a Hispanic running mate and former vice chair of the Florida Democratic Party, Annette Tadeo. She says looking at Chris' record, even when he was a Republican, the choice is still clear.
When he was governor, he did so many things that made us all so proud and proved that, that he represents the people and he makes decisions. Even when pushed to make other decisions by the leadership at that point of the Republican Party, he really made the right decisions. When it came to stimulus money, when it came to expanding the voting hours in 2008, and when it came to the environment, fought the utility companies, fought the insurance companies.
Still, not everyone within the Democratic Party has fully embraced Chris. Take Leslie Wims, founder of the Democratic African American Women's Caucus of Florida, as well as a black blogger. On her blog, Women on the Move, she's written columns like Why Nan Rich Supporters Will Never Support Charlie Crist and questioned whether Chris, quote, can be trusted to not change his stripes if Democrats send him to the governor's mansion, both written before and after the August primary. Now, though, she says she'll back him, so why the sudden change in tune?
I actually haven't changed my tune towards Charlie Crist, but what I have done is look at the bigger picture. And it isn't just about me. It isn't just about me and how I feel. It's about what affects the state, what affects African Americans.
She says the way she sees it, she's embracing Democratic principles rather than the person. Still, she says a lot of people have expressed to her their dislike for either candidate and want to stay home. But she says it's important they still get out and vote their values and at the same time hold that candidate accountable, in this case, Crist.
Now, do people change? Absolutely they change. And I am hoping that, you know, Charlie Crist will be true to his word once he becomes governor of the state of Florida again and does what he says he's going to do. And then if he doesn't, then you can best believe that the Democratic African American Women's Caucus will be holding him accountable.
Meanwhile, according to top Democratic Party executives, there have been concerns about the Republican-turned-independent-turned-Democrat switching parties and switching positions. But those same top officials say many people are being quiet to show the party as unified behind Crist. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Besides the candidates for Congress, governor, cabinet members, county, city, and school board, there are other matters vying for voters' attention. Among these, three amendments to the Florida Constitution. We'll look at those, logically enough, in numerical order. First, Jessica Palumbo examines Amendment 1. It's all about requiring the state buy sensitive lands for purposes of preservation. Supporters say it's one way to accomplish what the legislature has failed to do, while opponents say it micromanages the state's annual budget process.
Natural Bridge Battlefield State Park is a half hour southeast of the Florida Capitol Building.
This track we're looking at, which is part of what's called the Upper St. Marks River Corridor, is one of the projects that's been on the Florida Forever list for a long time, I think about 10 years.
Preston Robertson, a lawyer for the nonprofit Florida Wildlife Federation, is looking across the water.
Okay, so we're standing on what is a roadway that's been built here over
Correct.
This natural bridge. The water's flowing slowly.
In this case, the St. Marks River goes underground. It goes through the limestone and pops back up.
The state owns and manages this park. But north of here, the river flows through land owned by the St. Joseph Lumber Company. Purchasing that waterfront land is among the top priorities for a council that recommends land purchases under the state program Florida Forever. The Yes on One campaign says the land buying program is crucial to protecting the state's drinking water and preserving natural beauty that attracts big tourism dollars. And they say the amendment will ensure it continues.
Florida's growing again. Let's protect our water and land now for future generations without raising taxes.
Aliki Moncrief is field director for the Yes on One campaign, known as Florida's Water and Land Legacy. She says money for conservation projects hasn't always been hard to come by. When Florida's land purchasing program began about 20 years ago, its budget was $300 million a year.
Going back to governors like Bob Graham, Bob Martinez, Jeb Bush.
But its funding was zeroed out under Governor Charlie Crist and has inched up ever since.
Every single Florida governor has stood behind and understood the value of preserving land today so that we can preserve a beautiful Florida tomorrow. In 2009, that changed.
The Great Recession and the housing market crash had a lot to do with it. Money for Florida Forever came from a tax on real estate transactions. But when the housing market cratered, the shrinking number of transactions sapped the land fund, too. Since then, the legislature hasn't funded the program with anywhere close to $300 million. Florida Wildlife Federation President Manly Fuller says Amendment 1 would cut the legislature out of the equation, taking a third of property exchange tax revenue and earmarking it for conservation.
Our Constitution provides for this mechanism. It provides when the citizens do not believe that the legislature is meeting the needs that they would like to be addressed. There's a process, and we've gone through that process. We have approximately 1 million Floridians signed a petition.
Polling shows high public support for the idea, too. But some in state government are not Amendment 1 cheerleaders.
They're polling a population that has been grossly uninformed.
That's Umatilla Republican State Senator Alan Hayes. He says there's such a thing as too much conservation land.
We should not have a specified dollar amount nor a specified acreage amount that we're going to acquire. That is irresponsible.
Hayes says he wants stricter accounting of how purchased land will be used and what it will cost to maintain it.
It's just wrong to use dollars that could be used for health care or for education or for transportation just so we can buy some property. Somebody says, oh, yes, I'd be happy to take $6 or $8 million from the state of Florida for this property that I paid $200,000 for.
Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam says he also will not be voting for Amendment 1.
I am concerned about writing the state's budget into the state's constitution. And that's essentially what Amendment 1 does.
That was also the argument the Tampa Bay Times editorial board made against the amendment. But among Amendment 1's supporters are former Republican House Speaker Dean Cannon and cities and counties including Gainesville and Palm Beach. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Still to come on Capitol Report, opponents of Amendment 2 fear that measure will open the floodgates of marijuana in Florida, but supporters say their arguments are hazy.
The people who are telling you the caregivers are dope dealers are scaregivers.
We'll wrap up our state constitutional amendment overviews with Amendment 3.
The governor who was elected in this upcoming November 4th election will have the power to determine the entire balance of the Florida Supreme Court.
And voters in a few Florida counties will decide next week if they want their local children's councils to stay in business. The smart money, at least right now, seems to indicate a solid yes vote.
If you take care of yourself now, health-wise, you'll have less costs later on. It's the same thing with the children.
Next, we'll tackle Amendment 2, a measure that would make medical marijuana legal in the state of Florida. Nick Evans reports the amendment's critics say it will lead to full-scale legalization, but supporters argue those fears are overblown.
One of the first things to jump out about the debate over Amendment 2 is just how collegial the proponents of the yes and no campaigns have been. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd joined a debate hosted by the Polk County League of Women Voters earlier this month. Judd opposes the amendment while his opponent, personal injury lawyer John Morgan, has been the driving force behind getting Amendment 2 drafted and placed on the ballot. Here Judd speaks first.
I'm so enamored with that response, I'm not sure what he was responding to. We're going to start a country band with this thing. So we've been together so much, it's going to be called John and Judd, and we're going to have a band and go around and do state fairs.
But I was thinking about Judd and John.
Well, okay. Hey, anybody's got a gun can do whatever they want.
Morgan and Judd had the league in stitches all night, but despite the respect the two men have for one another, they definitely do not see eye to eye on Amendment 2. Judd argues Amendment 2 is a flawed proposition, but Morgan says he has answers for all of Judd's concerns.
He says he worries about children being prescribed medical marijuana by the doctor. I'm not. When's the last time your child ever got on his tricycle or bicycle and drove to the doctor's office for a doctor's appointment? What do you think the doctor would say if he got there?
get whole.
Now, Judd is correct. Amendment 2 does not define qualifying patient in terms of age, but the measure's author says existing Florida statutes require parents give consent before doctors can prescribe drugs to minors, and those prescriptions don't happen very often. According to a study conducted by the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program Center for Excellence at Brandeis University, prescription of opioids like OxyContin and oxycodone to people younger than 18 in Florida is exceedingly rare. What's more, the amendment specifically directs the Department of Health to construct a framework for medical marijuana's distribution. If the department believes an age restriction is prudent, it could consider adding extra requirements for people below a specific age. Judd also argues the measure is too vague about what conditions qualify for treatment.
Written in as a loophole, or other conditions. What's an other condition? Well, I'm not sleeping well at night. I stand up and my legs hurt. I've got a little stress in my life.
But similar wording comes up often in legal agreements. Think of the phrase including but not limited to, so common in contracts. Morgan says the amendment includes language for other conditions so the law is not too restrictive. Leaving the list open-ended puts the onus on the doctor and the Department of Health to determine when the benefits of using marijuana outweigh the risks. Judd also worries the proposal makes it too easy for ne'er-do-wells like drug dealers to get registered as caregivers with easy access to marijuana. But this issue and the last get into the finer points of a law's implementation, typically the purview of a regulatory agency like the Department of Health, and handled after a law's passage rather than before. The fourth concern Judd raises has to do with liability. The first part of the amendment states patients, caregivers, physicians, and treatment centers are not subject to criminal or civil liability except as provided in this section. Here's Morgan talking about this immunity.
Immunity is very limited. It's only for the prescription. You still can't do anything illegal. People, doctors who prescribe OxyContin have immunity. The immunity is extremely limited.
And the final clause is important, the except as provided in this section part. This means any one of the protected groups can be taken to court if they violate the terms of the amendment. Patients driving under the influence of marijuana could still be arrested. Physicians recommending marijuana in cases other than debilitating medical conditions could be brought to court. And caregivers using their access to sell marijuana to non-patients could be held criminally liable. Here's Judd's fifth argument against Amendment 2.
And then it not only allows smoked marijuana, but loophole number 5, they talk about developing related products containing marijuana. Think about that. Gummy bears, candy, cookies, you name it, you can have it under Amendment 2.
Of course, some might say that's a tad disingenuous because Judd criticizes medical marijuana based on the fact that it's often smoked.
There's no medical value in smoked marijuana. When's the last time you went to the doctor and they said, here, take this and go home and smoke it until you feel better?
And Morgan jokes with Judd about the discrepancy.
Look, he's hooked on these gummy bears. Every time I'm with this son of a gun, he's talking about gummy bears. I bet you if I went out to his cruiser, he's got a whole jar full of gummy bears because I've never been with him that he didn't talk about gummy bears. And because he's thinking, oh, the kids are going to 7-Eleven to get gummy bears. Listen. There's going to be edibles. He's worried about smoke. We can eat it as chocolate. We can do it as butter. And if Grady gets sick, I'm going to make a big batch of gummy bears and bring it up here.
Amendment 2 came about as a public initiative rather than a joint resolution from the House and Senate. Despite this path skirting the traditional legislative process, that doesn't mean lawmakers have no place. Amendment 2 includes a passage allowing the legislature to enact any law it wishes consistent with the provision. Should Amendment 2 pass, lawmakers would not be able to take medical marijuana away, but if the framework put in place by the Department of Health is lacking, the legislature will be able to step in and write laws addressing abuse. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
We wind up our overview of Florida's proposed constitutional amendments with Amendment 3. Unlike its companions, this one has not attracted a lot of attention, and as Lynn Hatter reports, that may be, at least in part, because the subject matter and the wording of the measure itself is a bit tough to understand.
In January of 2019, a new governor will be inaugurated. Inauguration Day is also when 3 new Florida Supreme Court justices will have to be named. And according to Brandon, Republican Senator Tom Lee, it's also the one day when, up until the actual inaugural ceremony, the state will technically have 2 governors serving. Florida's constitution is mum on which governor, the incoming or the outgoing, will get to make the appointments. And Lee believes the issue should be settled now.
We could end up with a major constitutional question about just whether or not justices were seated properly by a particular governor. And depending on the stakes involved in that, we could see a great deal of litigation ensue, following which a cloud is over the court in terms of their work product.
That's Lee earlier this year explaining a then bill that lays out a plan for addressing the situation. That bill is now Amendment 3. And Lee's take on it is this. Since the process for nominating new justices will start under the old governor, it should be the old governor who gets to make the appointment.
We don't know who we're talking about. If we try to do this in 2016, when this is right on the, over the horizon, there will be a whole lot of political discussion going on in this process based upon judicial philosophy about just who this benefits and who it doesn't. And I think this is the purest time for us to think about good governance and not politics.
But this is Florida, and the politics of the issue aren't being ignored. League of Women Voters of Florida Executive Director Jessica Lowe-Miner says Amendment 3 could give the next governor an unprecedented amount of power and influence over the Florida Supreme Court.
Those vacancies will actually be opening at the end of whomever is elected in this upcoming fall election, whether it is Rick Scott, whether it is Charlie Crist, the end of their term. So if Amendment 3 passes, the governor who was elected in this upcoming November 4th election will have the power to determine the entire balance of the Florida Supreme Court.
In 2018, Justices Barbara Pariente, Peggy Quince, and Fred Lewis all turned 70, the mandatory retirement age for a Florida Supreme Court justice. The Constitution allows them to serve out the end of their terms. This isn't the first time the situation has come up. In 1998, during the transition between outgoing Governor Lawton Chiles and incoming Governor Jeb Bush, the two men settled the issue by striking a deal on Justice Quince's appointment. But as Florida State University political scientist Carol Weissert says, those were different times. And in today's hyper-partisan political climate, such a deal would be much harder to strike.
Again, if you had the same party coming in following the same party, I would anticipate you would have more likely the two governors work together. If you have a mismatch, a Republican replacing a Democrat or Democrat replacing a Republican, then I would think that there would be perhaps less likelihood.
Justices Quince, Lewis, and Pariente make up the left-leaning wing of the Florida Supreme Court. And at a time when the governor's mansion and legislature are all controlled by Republicans, their replacements could change the balance of the court. But Weissert is frank about the amendment's chances.
Political science would say that the more complex a proposal, the least likely it will be to be accepted. So if it doesn't get the 60%, I think it's because it is more complex and difficult to explain.
Amendment 3 is formally called Prospective Appointment of Certain Judicial Vacancies, and it needs 60% of voters to say yes in order to be approved. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, besides all the statewide candidates and issues, there are lots of local decisions facing Florida voters. In a few counties, for instance, children's services councils are up for reauthorization by voters. Tiffany Termaney from member station WQCS in Fort Pierce reports the councils enjoy widespread support.
Voters in St. Lucie, Martin, Okeechobee, and Palm Beach counties will decide the fate of each county's Children's Services Council as they cast their ballot this November. That's because of a 2010 state law, which starting this year requires the councils to seek voter reauthorization every 12 years. Suzanne Wentley is the public education coordinator for the Children's Services Council of Martin County.
I can't say whether or not there's going to be dramatic changes in the quality of life in Martin County if this funding source goes away. What I can say is that 35 programs that are helping children and families in Martin County will likely go away because there is no other funding source available to them.
The funded programs range from prenatal care at Helping People Succeed to after-school activities at the Boys and Girls Club and free swimming lessons at the YMCA. There's a council in Broward County, which will also be on the November ballot. Plus, there's councils in Hillsborough and Pinellas counties, which don't need to be reauthorized until 2016, and in Miami-Dade, which has until 2020. Richard Geisinger is the president of the Martin County Taxpayers Association. He says the Children's Services Council of Martin County is beneficial to the community.
It's almost like preventative health care. If you take care of yourself now, health-wise, you'll have less cost later on. And the same thing with the children. If you invest in their future, they become productive members of society instead of ending up behind bars or stealing or drugs or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Sean Boyle is the president of the Children's Services Council of St. Lucie County. He says the council is important for the community as a whole, even if you don't have children.
You know, 24% of our community is made up of children 0 to 18. That's significant as far as when we look at the quality of life that we want in our community, we have to address that population as well.
Homeowners pay an average of $20 to $60 each year through their property taxes. Each council has its own millage rate, but none can exceed 0.5, which is 50 cents per $1,000 of a home's assessed taxable property value. The councils use that money to fund programs at local agencies. They also help the programs get state and federal grants. Geisinger says the Children's Services Council of Martin County has proven it uses that money wisely and that they use a great method of tracking the funds.
I think they're good at accountability. And when you have passion and accountability in the same group, it makes for a pretty successful organization. We've also seen in Martin County where the juvenile caseload at the courts have gone down some 60% since the 80s as population has gone up. Now, can you attribute that solely to the council? Probably not, but there's nobody that would say that they haven't influenced that number.
Paul May is the sheriff of Okeechobee County. He is yet another proponent of the Children's Services Council. He is grateful there is a council in Okeechobee County.
The Children's Service Council does a lot of things for children in Okeechobee County, a lot of positive things that without their support, especially their financial support, would not get done. And they do a lot of good.
He says just one example of the positive impact the council has on the Okeechobee community is how it helps teens in the drug court program pay their fees.
That keeps them out of this jail and saves taxpayers money.
While there's no apparent opposition, it remains to be seen if voters will support it. I'm Tiffany Termini in Fort Pierce.
Regular Capital Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.